This is a free call from an inmate at Little Sandy Correctional Complex.
Tell me some good news.
It's not good. I did an open records request, and one of the things that they sent me back, I was not expecting.
Hold on, what?
He was actually wanting me to get a $30,000 money order.
New at 11, the Courier-Journal reports a Lexington man convicted of murder was almost pardoned.
I'm Kristen Flum, and this is Taking Alex. At 31 years old, Mark Taylor was a convicted murderer, a complete 180 from the charming, charismatic transplant from Florida that had burst onto Lexington's social scene and immediately made friends all over the city. Up until December 20th, 2013, Mark was running in circles with people in state government, Kentucky's elite horse industry, club and restaurant owners, top-notch hairstylists, and even local TV personalities. I guess we've reached that point of full disclosure. I was one of them. In 2012, I was in a pretty awful relationship. If you've been there, you know that they can be roller coasters. Good for a while, then the bottom drops out. During those low times, I knew I could always count on one of my best friends to lift me up. He was my rock, a source of constant laughter and good times. He was, well, is, gay. And some of my best memories with him played out at Lexington's LGBTQ bars. And that's where I met Mark, on some random weekday after work, mixing and pouring drinks at a spot downtown. As we got up to leave, Mark grabbed my hand and said, "Let's do dinner." "No," I said, "I've got to figure out this crazy relationship. Thanks, but no thanks." "Coffee," he says. "No strings, just two new friends." I settled for coffee, and a few days later, we sat and talked for a couple of hours. Over the next couple of months, we saw a movie or two, grabbed lunch, and one night, my elementary-aged son and I accepted an invitation for a quick dinner at his place. To be clear, it was not romantic. Not at all. But admittedly, Mark made for good company. He was a big hit in my social circle. I never questioned whether or not he was a good guy. Long story short, I ended up staying in that toxic relationship I was in before I met Mark. And by deciding to do that, I cut all ties with Mark, deleted his number, never responded to random texts he sent over the next year. That was it. In the spring of 2013, I bumped into a mutual friend of ours at Keeneland, Lexington's historic spot for horse racing. He asked if I'd talked to Mark recently. I explained that it had been a long time. "Good," he said. "He's getting into some bad stuff. Drugs, a different crowd. He's cocky, arrogant. Has a driver," he told me with an eye roll. It was not the Mark that we knew. I never heard his name again until that Christmas, when I had to read it on the news. From what I'm hearing, Mark's bustling friend base dropped off significantly as soon as he was associated with this high-profile missing persons case. His wife, Fran, says they talked a lot about that in the beginning.
I was his only communication to the outside world because, half of his family let him down. Like, the other half of his family was still there, but he is not really a person who wants to bother other people with his prison life. So he always felt like, "I'm not gonna tell them stuff." He was really like into himself and he was just working on his case.
Mark is always working on his case. If you thought that he went away to prison quietly after his sentencing in 2016, you aren't the only one. Alex Johnson's family thought he did too. Here's Judy Johnson.
Well, I was absolutely sure that we wouldn't hear from him again, that he would just go away and hopefully be miserable in prison and not have the opportunity to get out and hurt anybody and disrupt anybody's life again. So it is disappointing that he manages to stir up trouble from time to time, but it's not totally unexpected in a way.
Mark Taylor almost immediately appealed his murder conviction to the Kentucky Supreme Court. He argued a kidnapping charge should have been exempt, that text messages and video had not been properly authenticated, that a doctor was not allowed to testify about Timothy Ballard's mental evaluation, and that the court refused to designate a particular juror as an alternate. Mark's argument was pages and pages long, all of it written and carefully documented by Taylor himself after weeks of legal aid training at Luther Luckett, another Kentucky prison Taylor has spent time in since his conviction. More than a year later, on November 17, 2017, after the high court reviewed it all, they issued a four-line response saying, quote, "Any errors that occurred at trial were harmless. The evidence against Taylor was ample. We see no reversible error here. We affirm the Fayette Circuit Court," end quote. What a relief to the Johnson family. Or so they thought.
Hey, Mr. Taylor, how are you? Miranda Combs.
9 months later, a colleague of mine at our news partner, WKYT, was invited to Eastern Kentucky Correctional Complex by Mark Taylor to talk about some surprise affidavits he'd received in the mail that Taylor claimed exonerated him. Mark Taylor had managed to plant a seed.
What if the state got it wrong? What if this man is serving time for a murder he didn't commit?
For well over an hour, Mark walked her through his problems with the conviction. He had new points to argue this time, different from what he appealed to the Kentucky Supreme Court. To Ms. Combs, Taylor swore again he wasn't beating his best friend, Alex Johnson, for 4 minutes in an empty spare parts parking lot. He was giving Alex CPR. He then produced four pieces of paper, affidavits he says proved he was wrongly convicted.
I've spent 1 year studying these, and no counsel's perfect.
According to these affidavits, including one signed by Timothy Ballard, all tell a different story than the prosecution.
One of them was from James Gayhart, one of the two callers to 911 the night of December 20th, who says he witnessed a man being beaten by a large man within a car. He admits in the statement he is a transient drug addict, and despite a subpoena to show up at Mark Taylor's trial, was a no-show.
Then, in March, another affidavit, this one from Ballard's girlfriend, Amy Roberts, that said she had lied to police about Taylor's involvement in the murder because Tim told her to.
And Mark was most surprised by the one signed on December 21st, 2017, from his co-defendant, Timothy Ballard.
Ballard starts, "I, Timothy Ballard, the affiant herein, hereby states under the penalty of perjury that Robert Taylor is not the person who killed Alex Johnson, nor did he participate in his kidnapping." It goes on to say, "I struck Johnson in the head with a broken baton that I carried around a few times until he stopped moving. I cannot live my life knowing that I am the reason an innocent man is in prison. I did not intend to cause Johnson's death. I swear this is the true and correct statement of the actual occurrences of that night."
Mark Taylor saw the affidavits as a step toward freedom.
What did you think when you read that?
I had goosebumps, my hair stand up, you know, on my arms. I called everybody I knew.
Do you immediately think I'm off the hook here?
Yes.
Mark acted shocked, giddy at all this new evidence, as he called it. But I can't help but be confused by what seemed like theatrics, because I've been researching this case for months, and after I got my eyes on the affidavits, two things immediately stood out. James Gayhart's affidavit was notarized by Mark Taylor's Aunt Carol, and I wish you could have heard her reaction the day I called to ask her about it. Even through the phone, I could feel her legs give out. Her voice shook as she cried, "No, no way would I have done that." Through tears, I knew she could have chewed nails. She was so mad. She said she'd been set up, and it had been 2 years since that document was stamped. She had no idea. I was the one to tell her about it. Carol and her husband Howard tell me they cut ties with Mark right after the trial. They've wanted nothing to do with him since. In fact, they'd been storing all of Mark's belongings since his arrest, and they tossed it all after Mark's conviction. Carol and Howard say that infuriated Mark. But they say they listened to the trial and heard too many holes in their nephew's story to believe Mark when he said he was an innocent man. Carol says she would have never notarized that statement from Mr. Gayhart if she knew the details in it or knew that the document was in any way tied to her nephew. But it's not a notary's job to look it over. Their only responsibility is to match the person's ID with their face and then watch them sign their signature. There are thousands of notaries in the state of Kentucky, and James Gayhart managed to walk into one of the dozens of banks in Lexington, ask for a notary, and get Mark's aunt? No way that's a coincidence. Moving on, I noticed a similar connection on Amy Roberts' affidavit. Roberts was Timothy Ballard's girlfriend at the time of the crime, but was actually in the hospital having surgery on the night of December 20th. That one was notarized by the sister-in-law of Mark Taylor's now ex-girlfriend, the one who Fran says showed up pregnant in one of Mark's prison visits. Mark relied on this girlfriend for help quite a bit. In fact, she's referred to as Mark's advocate in his appeals paperwork. I've agreed to not name names when it comes to people who are helping me connect these dots, but three people involved in this affidavit situation, three different people, including Mark's advocate, say those affidavits were written by Mark Taylor and sent to her to facilitate their signing. I kept making phone calls. From Luther Luckett Correctional Complex, Timothy Ballard told me on at least three occasions he did not write his affidavit. I took Tim's claim a step further. A website now exists called freemarktaylor.com. And above a picture of Timothy Ballard's affidavit, it reads, quote, "The below document is an affidavit that was written and dictated by Timothy Ballard to his lawyer and signed in front of a notary in December of 2017, end quote. Now, it may have been signed in front of a notary at the prison, but it was not dictated to Tim's attorney, Lindsay Perdue. I know that to be false because I've talked to Ms. Perdue. She'd never heard anything like that. This was all news to her. So two of the four affidavits were notarized by people very close to Mark Taylor, and a third is sketchy on the details about how it came to be. Yet he claims to Miranda Combs they just showed up out of thin air. I kept digging, and I never expected to end up in the rabbit hole that has kept my head spinning for weeks. 4 days after the jailhouse interview with Mark Taylor, at Mark's request, Miranda Combs sat down with that ex-girlfriend that I keep mentioning. And while the two were no longer dating, she offered to help Mark any way she could. The interview never aired on TV, and since she's moved on and separated herself from Mark Taylor, and at her request, I'm choosing not to name her. Her story is important, though, and I've talked to her quite a bit over the past few weeks. I mean, so do you think it's in 2018, in her sit-down with Miranda Combs, she talked about why, after the trial, she began reaching out to Tiny in jail.
Mark was actually trying to find somebody who would actually go and speak with him. Basically, like, you got what you wanted, now tell the truth.
Okay. When was that?
This was back in 2016. It was just a couple months after the trial.
Okay.
He and I had told him, I'm like, you know, I can do it. Like, I can go see him. It wouldn't bother me to do it. And he, you know, no, I don't want you to do it. I don't want you to get involved. But honestly, it was like, who would be the best person to really do it? You know, nobody else was really wanting to. And I'm like, you know, I'm actually telling you I will.
And did you know him?
No.
You did not know him at all? Because
did not know him at all.
He was a relatively new friend or acquaintance of Mark that he was
driving. Right. It was less than a year.
Okay.
Less than a year, I believe, where he worked at Riptides with him. But it was September of 2016 is when I went to go see him. And basically, I had lied to him and told him that I was Mark's cousin because it was just sounded better, I guess. I don't know why I did that, but... So he thought I was basically family, like trying to reach out to him, like, please help us. But, you know, he said that Mark owed him X amount of money, which, you know, I had taken notes and stuff while I was meeting with him, so I didn't forget anything. And there was a couple times I had seen him, so each time it had changed the amount of money that he owed him. And
to do what? To confess?
To confess, basically. It never said, if you give me this money, I'll confess. It was, if you give me this money, I won't let Mark rot in jail. He was actually wanting me to get a $30,000 money order and mail it into the jail under his mother's name. As though his mother was the one who was sending it to him, and that he would confess, sign an affidavit saying that Mark was innocent and that he was the one that committed the crime.
This woman tells me she relayed what Tim told her to Mark. She also consulted with an attorney who told her to leave it alone, warned her to not get tied up in whatever was going on. When Mark's friend stopped responding to Ballard and refused to visit him in jail again, she says she got angry letters from Tim. Here are a few lines from those letters.
I guess she thought this was an inappropriate word, game, So I guess I have to show you it's not a game. You brought this to me. I'm not a toy. You know who. Now get your inappropriate word down here or Mark rots.
So well, I don't even understand what that means. Get down there to do what? Give him money?
Basically, yes. This one is February 22nd of 2017. I hope and pray this letter finds you in good health. I have some information that you would like to have concerning the Robert M. Taylor case. Now, the only way you can get this info is to come and see me. No bull, just straight up talk. I'm sick. I've made my peace with God, so now I want to make my peace with others. Take time out of your day to find out what it is in my head. I promise you it isn't anything bad or a waste of your time, Tiny. Did you want me to read the last one? Okay. I don't want to hear that inappropriate word about your lawyer doesn't think it is a good idea for you to come see me. Your lawyer can't help Mark. I can. This is not about you. This is about helping your boyfriend. I have the power to help him or let it be, and he'll rot for at least 30 years. You said you had big... inappropriate word. Well, use them and come see me. No bullcrap. Just two people talking. I don't want a letter or someone else coming. I want to look you in your eyes. You're right. I am sick. It is a way of life. I made my peace with God. Now come make your peace with me. You started by lying to me the first time, so I lie to you. Now let's be grown-ups. If you want me to help Mark, get in your car and get your inappropriate word down here to see me. You have the power to help him or condemn him. What's it going to be, Tim?
Tim is angry. There's all kinds of foul language in those letters. So why, 14 months later, in December of 2017, would Tim Ballard do a complete about-face and allegedly dictate a confession exonerating him? We talked about that during one of my phone calls with Mark.
I have never had contact with this man. I've never written him. I've never tried to call him. I've never had any communication with this man about anything. From the beginning, from when he was in FCDC, up until, you know, after trial, he was attempting to extort me.
In your best guess, why all of a sudden, after pressing you and sending all these letters and, you know, getting in touch with and everyone, did he all of a sudden flip? Because there was anger in those letters.
Yeah, I don't exactly know. I can really tell you how it all came about, how I even thought or had an idea that he was going to change his testimony. His girlfriend, Amy Roberts, came and saw me at FCDC, and she essentially confessed to me there at the visitation booth. She confessed to me that he had actually done it, that he had confessed to her, that she was really sorry, and that he had pressured her into saying, you know, X, Y, and Z. You know, I should be expecting the hard questions, and I should be, you know, that's the whole point of this exercise. And really, nothing is out of bounds. I am not scared. That's kind of why I took it all as far as I took it. That's why I presented all these letters to Miranda Collins. That's why I put it out there. Even if it does look bad on me, I want it to be known that this man from the beginning was trying to get money for his testimony, for favorable testimony.
Mark Taylor used those affidavits to file another appeal to the Supreme Court, this time asking for a new trial. That, too, was denied. Recently, I asked Luanna Redcorn, one of the prosecutors who helped convict Mark Taylor, what she made of the affidavits.
This affidavit by Ballard, well after the fact, affidavits by others, well after the fact, have nothing really to do with the evidence that convicted him. And I can tell you as a prosecutor for now going into 34 years that there are times when witnesses recant, when they tell one thing at trial and then later, for whatever reasons, I won't even begin to speculate, whether it's pressure, money, cajoling, encouragement, who knows, file these affidavits. And that's why the courts don't give them very much consideration in setting aside verdicts where juries have heard all of the evidence and where these issues that are raised, like Timothy Ballard was really the killer, have been thoroughly examined in the trial. Ballard testified. He was cross-examined. That was Taylor's claim in the trial. Taylor testified. He said Ballard did it. So the jury, they heard all that. They heard all of that. And they still, all 12 of them, unanimously agreed that he was guilty.
And in record time, I mean, for a trial that lasted as long as it did, it was what, under 4 hours that they convicted him?
Yes. So that would cause me to say the proof was overwhelming.
In the fall of 2019, after all of the rejected appeals, Mark Taylor took a Hail Mary shot at freedom when he quietly and definitely without the knowledge of the Johnson family requested a pardon from Kentucky's one-term outgoing Republican governor, Matt Bevin. Weeks went by. Fran says Mark never heard a thing from Bevin's administration. They just assumed it fell on deaf ears or that the governor declined to consider it. Then, in July of 2020, a bombshell.
New at 11, the Courier-Journal reports a Lexington man convicted of murder was almost pardoned.
The news sent shockwaves through the Commonwealth and made the Johnson family sick to their stomachs.
That just terrified me. That is just the worst possible news I could hear. And I never dreamed that anybody would even consider giving him a pardon. So I was very upset when I heard that. And thank God, I'm sure there was divine intervention there.
Do you think any of his friends want to run into, you know, Alex's friends, do you think they want to run into Mark on the streets of Lexington? You know how traumatic that would be for them? You don't want Mark Taylor on the streets of your town. You don't. Not here, not in the Netherlands, nowhere. You don't. You want him exactly where he is right now, where he deserves to be, because he is a cold-blooded killer, and he doesn't feel sorry. He's not sorry. He hasn't lost a day of sleep over anyone but himself. He only cares about himself.
The Courier-Journal has hundreds of pages of records related to former Governor Bevin's pardons. In those, they found the draft of a full and unconditional pardon for Taylor, but it was never filed.
The news was just unbelievable. How in the world did he pull that off? I have to give you a little background about Matt Bevin. In Bevin's final days as governor of Kentucky, he signed off on 428 pardons and commutations, including convicted rapists, murderers, and drug offenders. By the time they were all filed, that number was closer to 600. The controversial clemencies raised all kinds of red flags.
This is Joe.
Hey, Joe. It's Kristen.
And piqued the interest of Pulitzer Prize winner and Courier-Journal writer Joe Sonka.
We started filing open records requests, I guess that first day after Bashir was inaugurated, when we started finding all these really controversial and remarkable pardons of people convicted of killings, murders, sexual abuse of children. So we started filing open records right away.
Sonka told me not long after that, a few documents trickled in. Then there was a lull.
The spring, all of a sudden, the Bashir administration said, we found some additional documents that go along with one of your previous requests, and they sent me some forms I had never seen before, some handwritten notes that appeared to be some kind of pardon review form, where Bevin's general counsel and attorneys were writing their recommendations for whether an applicant should receive a pardon or receive commutation or not receive any type of clemency relief.
How many of those would you say that were just handwritten like that you picked out of those files?
They handed over like a dozen or so, and that really caught my interest. So I filed another open records request for any of those handwritten documents dealing with pardons. And a while later, I got my response, and they said, well, we do have some of those documents, but we don't have them in our possession. Another government agency has them right now. We're going to have to wait to get them back from that agency. So I asked what agency that was, so maybe I could request it directly to them. And they said, well, it's the FBI. So eventually, once they got it back from the FBI, they turned it over to me, and there were about 700 of these pages. And a lot of them were Bevin's attorneys writing their recommendations. And some of them, at least they certainly appear to be, Bevin's own handwritten notes that were later, I guess, transcribed or typed up into official pardons and commutations and executive orders.
Sonka cross-checked all the handwritten clemencies he found with the Secretary of State's database that keeps record of all the pardons and commutations issued. Almost all of them had been filed.
almost every single one, but there was one that stood out to me talking about how someone was wrongly convicted of murder and how there were other guilty parties who had already confessed and sworn testimony. And I was reading this and I was like, why does this name not sound familiar? Like, I wrote about all these pardons of murderers and people with heinous crimes, and it said Robert Mark Taylor, and I looked it back up in the database and I couldn't find anything on that Governor Bevin had filed. And then I googled that name and all of a sudden, you know, the Alex Johnson murder pops up, and I'm like, oh my gosh, he actually wrote out a full pardon, at least on handwritten notes, for Mark Taylor, and yet there's nothing filed with the Secretary of State's office. I tried to contact Governor Bevin, former Governor Bevin, to see why that wasn't filed, if he meant to file it, if he wrote that out and then someone advised him, no, you don't want to pardon this person. That is still a mystery to me.
That handwritten ticket to Mark Taylor's freedom likely never would have been discovered had it not been for all the red flags raised and Joe Sonka's curiosity. Like Joe, I too emailed and left messages for Matt Bevin. No luck. I've reached out to the Secretary of State's office, Bevin's old staffers. No one is saying a word.
He called me the weekend after the pardon stories first started coming out. His first week out of office, he called me and spoke to me for about 45, 50 minutes, defending some of his most controversial pardons. I think the next week he called Terry Miner's WHAS talk radio host and made more defenses for his pardons. And since that time, I don't believe he's granted a single interview with anyone in the media. So I would really love to ask him why he wrote up that handwritten pardon for Mark Taylor and why it didn't get filed. If he got advice that this would be a bad idea to file it, or if he meant to file it, it was some clerical error that no one, you know, typed it up and submitted it to the Secretary of State's office. It's a fascinating mystery.
And get this.
But I reached out to Mark Taylor and see if he would talk and give any insight into if he had applied for this pardon, if he thought the pardon might be coming. And I was told that, yes, after the election, someone hand-delivered a pardon application to the governor. And according to Taylor's wife, this was hand-delivered to Bevin just 2 hours before that handwritten note was made granting Taylor a pardon. It says, per governor, November 18th, 2019, 6 p.m. And Taylor's wife says that was hand-delivered to him just 2 hours earlier. So there wasn't a lot of research done, I would assume, in 2 hours, unless one-sided research where Bevin was reading everything that Taylor gave for his side on why he deserved the pardon.
I remember I was at work and he called me and I told him, Mark, you are in the news. And he was like, what? I said, yeah. I said, apparently Bevin granted you a full pardon. And he was like, well, why am I still here?
I don't know what to make of any of it. Did the governor at all consider the jury's verdict or just the affidavits Mark provided before writing those notes? For months, I have wondered what Mark Taylor could have offered those four people in exchange for their new testimony. Those close to him tell me it wasn't money. If he had it, they say he would have hired his own attorney for his murder trial. Instead, he had a public defender. After working my sources, who are admittedly very uncomfortable talking about what they got tied up in with these affidavits, here's what I've gathered. One says they were threatened, and the others got promises. Mark's ex-girlfriend says they were told that if their statements helped free Mark, they'd be taken care of the rest of their lives. Bills? Don't worry about him. Oh, and one got $40, all that the ex-girlfriend had in her purse the day one statement was notarized. I'd love to ask Mark about it, but he hasn't called in over a month. He prefers to email, and the last few criticized my reporting, said he felt like I was trying to convict him a second time or frustrate his appeals. He really likes to tell me which questions I should be asking. I describe it kind of like a shell game. Don't look over there. Look at this. Ask this. The problem with that is his questions have been addressed and even considered by the Kentucky Supreme Court and the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals. As of January of 2021, not one has sided with him. We may never know what happened the night of December 20th, 2013, or why. Tim and Mark tell vastly different stories, and Alex is dead. I have listened to every minute of the trial. I've heard the testimony, done my own digging, picked detectives' brains, and found new things that don't add up. And maybe most importantly, I've seen the spare parts video with my own eyes. It's damning. It made me want to throw up. Like the prosecutors pointed out, you can clearly tell who is who in the video. And I haven't found one person yet who says what they saw looks anything like CPR. In one of the last emails from Mark just before Christmas, he wrote, quote, "I challenge you to find any conduct by me questionable. I feel like I've found plenty, and I'm not even done telling you about it." In the fall of 2020, Mark and Fran shared with me their plans to pursue legal action to find out why the governor's handwritten pardon was never filed. The Taylors also told me Mark had filed a new pardon request to current Kentucky Governor Andy Beshear.
Tell me some good news.
It's not good. I did an open records request.
Which led me to write an open records request to the governor's office, asking for anything that Mark Taylor had submitted to be considered for a pardon.
And one of the things that they sent me back, I was not expecting.
And any documents that may have been sent in by Fayette County prosecutors or Lexington police contesting it, since I knew they were fuming mad to hear about the first request. In early fall, I received an email saying that Governor Beshear's staff had found 45 pages of documents related to my request. About 40 pages of it were Mark's documents, an official application, his background info, a plea written in his own words, those affidavits from James Gayhart, Amy Roberts, and Timothy Ballard, and letters from Mark's family showing support for him. But I also got something else.
It was a letter from the police department, or an email from the police department, of a letter that they had intercepted, I guess, from Tiny, discussing payment of money in exchange for his confession.
Hold on, what?
It seemed to catch Mark off guard, but he realized he had seen the letter and had it as part of his files. There's no date on it, but Lexington police say it was intercepted by guards at the Fayette County Detention Center about 3 months after the trial, somewhere around the fall of 2016. The return address is D. Mand, but the handwriting matches other letters that Tim Ballard has penned. He writes, quote, "You lied to me. You swore on your mother and father's grave there would be $100,000 in Alex's house, and you also swore I would receive $60,000 for helping you. You gave me $18,000 and you took $20,000 and all of the dope and left town. The only way I will help you is for you to pay half of what you owe me. See, only I have the power to get you out. Your life is in my hands," end quote. Ballard wrote that if Mark showed good faith and cleared the almost $900 that Tim owed his commissary account, quote, "I'll get the paperwork started on the murder case." He closed out the letter, "P.S., I have nothing to lose, but you have everything to gain," end quote.
Yeah. So there's like five or six different extortion sort of letters.
When I read it to Mark, he told me that that was just an extension of the extortion letters that his ex-girlfriend began receiving after she visited Tim at the Fayette County Detention Center. From what I understand, Mark nor the ex-girlfriend ever reported the letters to police, but they did file them with the court. I am positive this one is on official record now because Detective Rob Wilson sent the intercepted letter to Governor Beshear's chief of staff in August of 2020, just 2 days after the governor's office had learned that Mark asked Kentucky's current governor for a pardon. Detective Wilson wrote to Andy Beshear's counsel, Latasha Buckner, quote, "I've intercepted a letter between the two subjects discussing payment for the affidavit in an attempt to free Taylor, just wanting to make sure this guy gets the sentence the jury gave him," end quote. Buckner emailed back, "I was informed we do have it. Go ahead and send it to us." With all of this new stuff, I asked to talk to Mark again, and I still haven't heard back. Prosecutor Luanna Redcorn isn't surprised that Mr. Taylor continues to fight his conviction.
"I thought that Mark Taylor certainly considered himself, I thought, the smartest person in the courtroom, and honestly thought that he could get away with this. I'm like everybody else, just shocked absolutely shocked that the governor would consider this at all, and obviously consider it with no real understanding of what the evidence was in the case. I mean, the evidence in this case is overwhelming in my mind. And I think to have pardoned him, as it was for some other individuals, would have been a complete abuse of a power and authority. I think that others agree with that. I think you probably realize that at least one Republican senator filed a constitutional amendment trying to limit the powers of a governor to pardon people during the end of the administration. So I think that Taylor's not being pardoned very well may have been divine intervention.
If Mark Taylor did not kill Alex Johnson, the way he is attempting to prove it seems to me really suspect. In my last email from him, he brought up James Gayhart again. He said, "I'm not examining that witness thoroughly enough." The irony of putting all of his proverbial eggs in that basket, I can't wrap my head around. How is Mr. Gayhart any more credible than Tim Ballard, the man who Mark's attorney attacked in her closing statement? Miss Downs played up Ballard's criminal history, the robbery and kidnapping he committed in Alabama, and his threats to the president later. You can't believe Tiny's account of what happened that night. He's a felon, Sandra Downs said. But Mark wants me to seriously consider Gayhart's story? Seems a bit hypocritical. Mr. Gayhart has a rap sheet a mile long. On a website that keeps court records, I counted nearly 50 criminal cases where the 56-year-old Lexington man is named in 9 Kentucky counties dating back to 1984. Things like cashing bad checks, stealing, petty shoplifting, being a public nuisance, tampering with evidence, drugs, DUIs, the list goes on. I'll end with this. I didn't set out on this project to re-examine facts of the case. I am not, nor have I claimed to do the work of the Innocence Project. I set out to tell the heartbreaking story of what murder victims' families go through after these senseless crimes. I wanted people to remember Alex Johnson and the giant footprint he left on this earth. I did, however, look into the things Mark suggested. And in the end, they only raised more questions. One thing that I have never heard is any sort of remorse from Mark. Not an apology, not a tear shed, not a word about what the Johnson family must be going through. In fact, Mark still refers to Alex as the man. Listen.
And moving beyond that, they say that I was sitting in the backseat attacking the man.
Can I ask you something really quick, because you've now said it twice. Why do you call him the man?
The man? What do you mean?
You don't say Alex. You say the man. And you did at trial, too.
Yeah, I had it, I guess. The victim, the man, because I'm serving surviving litigation. That's how it's addressed. The victim, the man in the front seat, the man in the back seat. Like, everybody doesn't have a name or a label, the man in the back, the man, the driver, I don't know exactly.
Well, I just noticed, like, on the stand, you said, I hated what happened to the man, and you don't ever say Alex. And I think that's the biggest problem that people have is you've never.
Thank you for using security.
All right, bye.
A little sympathy might have gone a long way in Mark's case, but the Johnson family has never heard from their son's murderer. Not a word. But this caught me by surprise. I know you never heard this reported on the news. After his testimony at Mark's 2016 trial, Tiny had a request for Judge Thomas Clark.
After the trial, there was a moment that you guys had with Timothy Ballard.
Mm-hmm. Our victim advocate basically said, once everyone had left the room, they said, just stay right here. And then they said, Timothy Ballard wants to talk to you all. He wants to apologize. The judge said that he can, but you all can't say anything back. Is this okay for you all? And we were okay, yeah, absolutely. Let him, friends, family. We waited, jury left, everyone else left, but the bailiff, brought him in, and he talked to us probably for at least 2 minutes and just said how sorry he was for his involvement in the murder, and that he wants our forgiveness, basically just that, just how sorry he was for helping Mark kill Alex.
It wasn't much, but it was something. Something Mark Taylor, a man who called himself one of Alex's best friends, has never done in the more than 2,500 days he's had to think about it.